By means of thin spaces between the braids of matting, the place was open to the air, but not to view. There was also a round opening on one side, only large enough, however, to admit the arm, but this aperture was partially closed from within. In front, a deep-dyed rug of osiers, covering the entranceway, was intricately laced to the standing part of the tent. As I divided this lacing with my cutlass, there arose an outburst of voices from the islanders, and they covered their faces as the interior was revealed to my gaze. Before me crouched a beautiful girl. Her hands were drooping, and like a saint from a shrine, she looked sadly out from her long, fair hair. A low wail issued from her lips, and she trembled like a sound. There were tears on her cheek, and a rose-colored pearl on her bosom. Did I dream? A snow-white skin, blue firmament eyes, Golconda locks. For an instant spellbound, I stood, while with a slow, apprehensive movement, and still gazing fixedly, the captive gathered more closely about her a gauze-like robe. Taking one step within, and partially dropping the curtain of the tent, I so stood as to have both sight and speech of Samoa, who tarried without, while the maiden, crouching in the farther corner of the retreat, was wholly screened from all eyes but mine. She declared herself more than mortal, a maiden from Orulia, the island of delights, somewhere in the paradisical archipelago of the Polynesians. To this isle, while yet an infant, by some mystical power she had been spirited from Ama, the place of her nativity. Her name was Yila. And hardly had the waters of Orulia washed white her olive skin and tinged her hair with gold, when one day strolling in the woodlands, she was snared in the tendrils of a vine. Drawing her into its bowers, it gently transformed her into one of its blossoms, leaving her conscious soul folded up in the transparent petals. Here hung Yila in a trance, the world without all tinged with the rosy hue of her prison. At length, when her spirit was about to burst forth in the opening flower, the blossom was snapped from its stem and borne by a soft wind into the sea, where it fell into the opening valve of a shell, which in good time was cast upon the beach of the island of Ama. Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaian Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered here and there across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is the navigator, John Lash, recording on the 16th of February, 2014, Nav Briefing number 110, the GNE in summation. As a prelude to this briefing, I read a few paragraphs from a novel by Herman Melville called Mardi, M-A-R-D-I. Of course, Mardi is the French word for Tuesday, hence Mardi Gras. Mardi also is the name of the key male character in this novel. I discovered Mardi a good many years ago. I guess it would have been back in my collegiate days at the University of Maine in the winter of 1963 and into 1964. I remember that they had a collection of the complete works of Herman Melville in the university library. I remember that volumes were appropriately printed or bound in a nautical blue. Perhaps that's the color of nautical blue, to borrow for the logs of the GNE when they eventually transposed into a written form, and bound as books. Herman Melville is a really important character in the adventure of the GNE, as well as in the adventure of Starbase, interestingly. And what can I say about him right now? Well, he was born with some manifold in the whales, which is quite appropriate considering he's most known for his novel about whales. Marty, however, was really a critical work in Melville's life. And one might find it written in a fantastic and lyrical manner that equals and excels Moby Dick in some ways. Marty, which is subtitled, and A Voyage Thither, get that word, thither, T-H-I-T-H-E-R, is beautifully relevant to the whole GNE adventure, because we are, after all, on a great nautical odyssey, are we not? We are navigating by the stars, and we are understanding that the mothership herself navigates in interstellar space and also in intergalactic space. There are many points of relevance in the life and work of Herman Melville that might at some point engage your interest. I just happen to have Marty hanging around since I got my books down at Ambergain in October of 2012. I pulled it out, and I've actually had it on hand off and on during the course of the GNE. I was happy to be able to find that novel again. It's dated, the day I acquired it was dated the 20th day of the Capricorn Lunation in 1980 in Santa Fe. So that would have been sometime in January 1980, Santa Fe. So I was glad to find it. I love all the works of Herman Melville. I've read almost all of them down through the years. And Marty is well worth reading if you can still read, if you still enjoy reading. It is, in my view, an epic accomplishment of the period of Romanticism in which Melville lived and in which he represented, along with the other American Romantics and Transcendentalists, such as his close friend Nathaniel Hawthorne, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Poe, and Thoreau, and the rest of the usual suspects from the American Transcendentalist movement. Anyway, I'd just like to point out in passing that Yila, the flower maiden, who is a character, you could say, not exactly a real-life personage, but more or less of a supernatural character in Mardi, is the fictional counterpart representing one of the dreaming identities of the Aeon Sophia. To be precise, Yila, from Oceania, was the fourth dreaming identity in her fugue, her oniric fugue, that is to say, O-N-E-I-R-I-C, which refers to dreaming. And fugue, F-U-G-U-E, which refers both to a musical fugue, that is to say, a composition that builds by levels and layers and cadences and tonalities and chords, but also an escape, a fugue, a flight. From the very moment of her first dreaming identity, which condensed in the figure of Justine in the imagination of the Marquis de Sade, who was imprisoned in the Bastille in Paris, from that very moment, the Ansifier awoke in a lucid dream in which she found herself always fleeing. She's in a constant fugue. Each of the female characters in the seven identical nodes, up to and including Vivi, were all fleeing in one way or another. They were fugitive characters in difficult and fugitive situations, or evasive characters. So of those seven dreaming identities, including Vivi, which is current, Yila was the fourth. And Melville actually foresaw in his imagination around the year 1850, he actually foresaw the coming of the consciousness of the Ansifier into human imagination as a numinous figure, and he represents that figure in the pages of Mardi. So what I read was a passage, a few paragraphs from chapter 43, entitled The Tent Entered. And in this chapter, you witness the dramatic moment in the novel about a fourth of the way through when the protagonist, Mardi, who is a sailor shipwrecked in Polynesia, first encounters the mysterious figure of Yila. Now, it's certain that Herman Melville was not deeply versed in comparative mythology. And in any case, what materials would he have had at hand around 1850 when he wrote this novel? I'll have to go back and look in his biography for a few more details about the circumstances of writing Mardi. It's extremely interesting to read what he was facing at that time. Also, the kind of mythophrenic breakdown that he went through while he was writing Moby Dick. Wow, can I relate to that? I mean, you as well, I'm sure, can relate to that. It's extremely interesting to see how the human endopsyche seizes upon the instrumentality of certain genius specimens of the Anthropos and as it were, in a manic state of possession, really, produces the artistic and creative outpouring that belongs to the entire endopsyche. So it was the entire endopsyche of humanity at the moment that Melville wrote Mardi who recognized who is Yila. Recognized in a literary imagination of humanity, who is the Aeon Sophia as she becomes lucid in her own dreaming. Now, as I was just saying, Melville didn't have access to any materials of comparative mythology, but it's quite likely that he had even better, because he had sailed among the Polynesian and Melanesian peoples for a number of years, in his 20s, I believe. He had certainly heard the tales of local mythology among those island peoples. It's more than likely that he heard the story of a Polynesian goddess, as if you will, a Polynesian vegetal goddess, known as Hainuwele, Hainuwele. Now, the legend of Hainuwele, who is sometimes called the Coconut Girl, was first recorded by a German ethnologist around 1940. So that was considerably after Melville lived. But nevertheless, I wouldn't be surprised if Melville drew from that myth for his representation of the figure of Yila. There are certain really close parallels. Something that often happens with the workings of the human endopsyche is that the endopsyche secretes its contents into the mind and feelings and imagination of a human animal. And then that human animal, in turn, develops and matures that secretion and releases it in a modified form as an embellished or elaborated myth, you see. And this is certainly what you and I are doing together in an orchestrated activity, what you and I are doing with the myth of the Aeon Sophia. It may well have been what Melville was doing, or what the endopsyche was doing through Melville in regard to the Polynesian myth of Hainuwele. Joseph Campbell also wrote extensively about that legend in The Masks of God. I can't remember which volume it is, but he describes it at length. And he relates it, I believe, not only to the people of the Maluku Islands, where it was originally discovered, but to the Kanak culture of Melanesia or Micronesia, I can't remember. The figure of Hainuwele, like that of Yila, is a vegetal goddess which is technically called a Dima deity in the studies of people like Campbell, a Dima deity or Dema deity. And that word refers to the vegetal power of the earth, the power of the plant world. So the deities in that category are often representations of totemic plants. Just considering Yila as representative of a Hainuwele type Dima goddess associated with coconut, well, just considering that for a minute, you might want to take a look at the essay in the Alternative History of the Grail. It is The Radiant Wisdom Stone, one of the chapters, lesson 4, I think it is, in that sequence on medhistory.org. And if you scroll down to the subheading, which is the wisdom light, of course, talk about the character of the organic light, which is unique and unmistakable. And there is always a maiden associated with that light, the Grail Maiden, who bears the Grail in Parzival. And going far back into Celtic and Nordic and Icelandic folklore, there is a witch or maiden of some kind always associated with the organic light. That is to say that human animals have always intuited the presence of the Aeon Sophia in the organic light, and they have experienced the organic light. Members of our species have experienced the organic light in countless ways, spontaneously down through the ages. But you'll find there, if you scroll down in that subheading, a reference to, here we go. Comparison of the organic light to milk is widespread, not only in the European arcana, but also in worldwide mythology. In a classic work of comparative mythology, Myths of Pre-Columbian America, Donald A. McKenzie devotes a long chapter to the milk goddess and her pot, citing dozens of examples of a white goddess associated with milk elixir from sacred milk-yielding trees and plants. End quote. So there you have an example from comparative mythology of the theme or mytheme of the milk goddess slash white goddess and her pot. And indeed, what is a coconut but a pot of milk? And when you split the coconut, you have two pots. You have the milky water inside the coconut to drink, and then you have the white flesh of the coconut, which bears a certain similarity to the whiteness of the organic light. So, who knows? We don't necessarily have to assume that Herman Melville experienced the organic light. It's very probable that he did without knowing what he was seeing. That's the trick, of course. The trick, of course, is to know what you're looking at when you're seeing it. That's why some initiatory cueing can be helpful. But in any case, you have that lovely scene from Marty describing his first encounter, Marty's first encounter with the Polynesian flower maiden, Yila. And I leave you to search that out and read it, or re-listen to my reading. And I leave it to you to determine certain resonances that you might find in that paragraph. Resonances or consonances that might trigger associations in your mind as you reread or re-listen. There hung Yila in a trance, the world without all tinged with the rosy hue of her prison. At length, when her spirit was about to burst forth in the opening flower, the blossom was snapped from its stem. End quote. You know, the endopsyche does not belong to anyone. And so the fantasy, if you will, and the literary invention of a writer in the middle of the 18th century can recur 100 years later in somebody's dream. Anyway, just thought that would be a fitting introduction to this particular briefing, in which I'd like to just review a little bit of what we have accomplished in the GNE, to sum it up, to bring you up to date with the current parameters, and to look ahead to what's coming. First off, on the current parameters, right now, we're in the Matangi shift of 2014. The midpoint of the shift was a couple of days ago with the full moon, beautifully seen here, beautifully observed here in Spain. And you will note that the full moon occurred 2 or 3 days after the moon passed its apogee in 24 degrees of Cancer at the head of the twins. So that's why the full moon appeared particularly small, because although it was not exactly in its apogee, it was on that point of its elliptical orbit that is located more distant from the Earth, most distant from the Earth. Also, I'd point out that we are now coming out of a stall. So I would say the high point of the stall has been within the Matangi shift here, probably around the 10th, 11th, or 12th of February. And so the moon, when it passed its apogee on the 12th in 24 Cancer, was beginning to pull out of the stall. And so in the next event of apogee, the next apogee moment, March 11th, the apogee will have advanced to 28 Cancer. So it's moving now out of the stall at a good rate, a good steady rate of about 1 degree a week. And that stall of the lunar apogee in the twins, close to the head stars of the twins, marked the third and final lesson of the GNE concerning doubling the third attention, which is the mirroring attention, and concerning the master theme of duplicity. As I speak, we're just short of 1 month to March 19th, which would be the third anniversary of the inception of Reset, and correction begins at the spring equinox. In 2014, a couple of other upcoming events you'd want to observe. Well, on the 27th of February, there is a perigee moment with the moon located at its perigee in 16 degrees of Aquarius. That puts it in the arc of the goatfish. And remember that Venus has been the morning star since the beginning of February. She has reappeared in the morning sky. She advances each morning higher and higher in the sky as she races ahead of the sun. And so Venus herself, on the 4th of March, returns to the position where she turned stationary retrograde. That is to say, 29 degrees of Capricorn, placing her in the empty space before the gaze of the goatfish. So Venus turned retrograde in that position on the 23rd of December, and thereafter she went into her underworld passage. She emerged in the beginning of February. She's clearly visible now as the morning star. And so, toward the end of this month and the beginning of March, you'll see Venus advancing, returning to the place where she was in the empty space, and advancing rapidly into the goatfish. So I would say that the formal and precise moment of the completion of Reset would correspond to the moment when Venus advances into the goatfish and reaches the degree of the lunar perigee in this Matangi shift, that is to say, of 16 degrees of Aquarius. Now, this is granular detail of the cosmic writing, okay? This is how a star diviner reads and follows the sky. To a certain extent, you would depend on the ephemerides to show you the timing and to indicate things that are not observable. But everything that you get from the textual ephemerides or from the archonic simulation devices such as Stellarium needs to be confirmed by direct observation. What I'm saying now, you can observe. And that would be, interestingly, amazingly, that on the 23rd of March, Venus reaches 16 degrees of Aquarius in the arc of the goatfish. That's the position of the lunar perigee on the 27th of February. Do you see my reasoning here? And you don't have to be precise down to the last second on this matter. There is plenty of granular detail to indicate to us that the reset culminates within a period of 2 or 3 days between the 19th of March and the spring equinox 2014. I should point out that whenever you observe the retrograde cycles of any planets, whether they be innermost planets such as Venus between the Earth and the Sun, or Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn beyond the orbit of the Earth, should always take note of when the planet returns to the place where it initially went retrograde. That is the completing moment of the retrograde cycle. So Venus went retrograde, as I said, in about 28 or 29 degrees of Capricorn, December 23rd, and she returns to that place on the 4th of March 2014. And it's remarkable, the timing is remarkable, because at the same moment that she does so, there occur other events between the 3rd and 8th of March. Remarkable events, a remarkable concurrence of timing. Mars turns stationary retrograde in 28 degrees of Libra, that is in the Virgin, the day before Venus returns to her retrograde station, as it's called. On that same day, Saturn turns stationary retrograde in 24 degrees of Scorpio, preparing to make its perfect loop around the vertex or vertical beam of the scales. And at the end of that week, on Friday, the 7th, Jupiter turns stationary direct in 11 degrees of Cancer, which is in the lower mid torso of the twins. So this is a remarkable concurrence of events. It reminds me of the image of the one-armed bandit in the casino. When you pull the handle of the one-armed bandit and you get three bananas or three cherries or whatever, this is really quite extraordinary that these three events of the three outer planets, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, would occur within 5 days of each other. And in addition to that, those of us who observe things in granular detail can see that that week is also a key moment in the retrograde cycle of Venus. Wow. And what a charged month I would expect March of 2014 to be as the reset ends and the world moves into correction, whether it know it or not. So with those remarks, come to the half-hour point of this briefing. In the remaining 45 minutes, I'd like to offer not exactly a summation overview of the GNE. Perhaps that's a little too ambitious. Certainly is too ambitious to consider right now. I wouldn't even have the patience myself to go back and crawl through even the titles of the briefings to pull out what have been the outstanding themes so far. So the most that I can offer in my current state of mind is a kind of a reprise of certain issues. Of course, there are threads hanging. There are aspects of the GNE that have not been adequately considered. For instance, I really didn't give you any kind of coverage whatsoever of the perigee hits in the Scorpion and Snake Tamer, did I? Or even in the Archer, did I? I think I made some approaches. I think I might have mentioned that the perigee hits in the Archer clued me to the subject of institutional child abuse that reaches to the highest agencies of power and authority. That particular theme, which I proposed as the theme for empathic focus for our species, came up during the period of those perigee surges in the Archer for particular, very particular reasons, but I haven't taken the time to lay that out to you precisely. I sometimes, you know, allude to things and I don't follow up with them. There are too many things to follow up with, as you certainly realize. So I'll just pick up a few clues that are floating around here today and pick up a few of the dangling threads of the GNE, and let's consider that the best summation that I can offer you at this particular moment in time. I'd like to refer to an email I got just a couple of days ago, bringing up the subject of Sandy Hook and the subject of Galen Windsor and his extraordinary claims about radioactivity. Crew member Jason writes, and I quote, "Let me reiterate my points on Windsor. The particular evidence he produced looks good to someone who isn't knowledgeable about the particulars that a nuclear engineer is privy to. The water in containment tanks is generally safe, as the water provides an excellent shield against radiation, which is one of the reasons why H2O is necessary to organic life, as the ozone layer and atmosphere protect us from cosmic radiation on this planet. He employed other tricks and traits similar to this, but they were all generally harmless. I would likely have fallen for this as well if I had not looked into these issues previously, however. I do think much of the Fukushima diatribe is overblown, but it's still a massive tragedy, and with radiation it isn't an instant kill. but we cannot really gauge its effects yet. The sailor who saw a dead ocean is overblown, but radiation is slow kill. Perhaps the answer lies somewhere in between, end quote. So, he's referring to an article which appeared on the internet in December, I think, entitled, "The Ocean is Dead." And this was an article given in written form based on the eyewitness account of a sailor who sailed across the Pacific. The account includes, in his description, in his words, or the words that were taken down by the person interviewing him, on a horrific situation, as if to imply that the Pacific was entirely dead, there were no fish left, and there are massive whirlpools of plastic and garbage and radioactive debris from Fukushima floating here and there. What struck me when I read this article, which was forwarded to me in December, I think, was that there were no photographs, and there was no link to video footage. Now I ask you, if someone is sailing across the Pacific Ocean, in this day and age, are you going to tell me that they are not going to take photographs of what they see, especially if what they see is as alarming and massive as described in the account of this sailor? As soon as I read that account, the ocean is broken, excuse me, not the ocean is dead, the ocean is broken, I was alerted by two things. First of all, the syntax is wrong. The ocean cannot be broken. Humanity will be long gone before the ocean is broken. You can be sure of that. And even if the food chain in the Pacific Ocean is broken, humanity will be long gone before the ocean itself is broken. So I was disturbed by that language, and my bullshit detector went on high alert upon reading that article. It's another Mephisto situation. It's like Sandy Hook again. Oh, this sailor has seen as horror, the horror of the death of the ocean, which is equivalent to the horror of the death of those children at Sandy Hook. But no one can see the evidence. You can't see the pictures of it. That's a Mephisto trick. We should know that by now. So, going back to the Matangi shift of last year, or I don't know when it was, when did I bring up the Mephisto material? Whether or not it was during the Matangi shift, we know that the problem of Mephisto is intimately related to Matangi because it is she, unique among the Mahavidyas and Diamond Sky Dakinis, who carries the power to defeat the trickster at its own game. Okay? Now, to read further into this article. Oh, first of all, let me comment on Windsor. I think it's very likely that Galen Windsor was a plant and that he was actually a double agent working for the Nuclear Energy Commission. But there's something really, really inexplicable and bizarre and irreducible about Galen Windsor and his testimony. There, when you, as I've said before, as I've advised before, when you encounter in world affairs or in the account of any particular event, such as the Sandy Hook massacre, alleged, such as Fukushima, when you encounter, as a human animal, things that just don't make sense on the face of it, you've got to know that you're being conned. You've got to know that you are right, that your animal instincts are true. You've got to know that there's a psyop taking place. Unfortunately, you're then in an excruciating situation because it's not always possible to tell what is the point of the fracking psyop. You know, what is the point of the psyop of Galen Windsor or Fukushima? Or Sandy Hook. It doesn't mean that something didn't actually happen at Fukushima, because it did. But the narrative carries the psyop. Likewise, the narrative of Galen Windsor is really bizarre. He may have been there to
promote, in some respects, the nuclear industry by saying it's really not dangerous. But look closely at what he actually says, you know. What he actually says is that, of course, it's dangerous, like any other industry is dangerous, like coal plants, plants that produce, you know, that refine petroleum. I mean, it's all incredibly dangerous. These industrial processes are dangerous. What he is saying specifically is that the so-called long-range invisible radiation that is only detectable by Geiger counters and so forth is fictional, is fraudulent, that there is in fact no risk of long-term contamination from radioactive substances. And in addition, he said, bear this in mind, he said, plain as day, that there is no real possibility that any nuclear plant could melt down. The China syndrome, he said, was a script, and he knew who wrote it. Nuclear engineers wrote that script, and then it was taken up by Hollywood writers and planted in the mind of the human species. Well, I have to say that so far it is a fact that there hasn't been no meltdown from any nuclear plant disaster. A nuclear plant disaster is like a disaster in a propane tank storage or in a fireworks facility. But the notion that a nuclear plant, every single nuclear plant on the Earth, has the potential to melt down into an unending atomic reaction may not be true. And he may have well been telling the truth in that respect. And he may as well have been telling the truth about radiation disease over long term. Because as far as I can see, look at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They were rebuilt within months. They were thriving cities within 5 or 10 years afterwards. And there is no record, as far as I know, of the generations of people who were in immediate proximity to the moment of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945. No record of them massively dying off due to cancers attributed to radiation disease. And people die of cancers anyway from all kinds of causes, mainly nutritional, the presence of heavy metals in the food chain. There are innumerable causes of cancer, smoking. So how are you going to tell in a general population if they are dying at an escalating rate due to the exposure to nuclear radiation? It's impossible to assess, really. Also, I am strongly inclined to believe that half-life is a complete fiction. First of all, almost everything in 20th century science, Einstein, Planck, and so forth, is bullshit. It's a fiction. It's a mathematical fiction. Black holes are a mathematical fiction. They do not exist. There is no way scientifically, evidentially, to confirm that black holes exist by definition of what they are. There is no way empirically, scientifically, statistically, to confirm that certain radioactive materials have a half-life of hundreds of thousands or millions of years. It's inconfirmable. It is not science. It cannot be, according to the criteria of Karl Popper, falsified. It is non-falsifiable. And if a proposition is non-falsifiable, that doesn't mean that it's true. No, it means that it's dangerously, ambiguously untrue, and that it only operates as an assumption. And the assumption of truth in the case of a non-falsifiable proposition, such as, quote, half-life of radioactive materials, unquote, is an extremely dangerous assumption that can lead human animals far away from an accurate and verifiable perception of the processes of nature. So I have to say that if Galen Windsor was a double agent, if he was a shill, and if there was a psyop involved, there was at least some remarkable truth in this psyop. I think it's an enormous wake-up call for the human species. Were we to know, 3 years on from Fukushima, 3 years on at the completion of reset, were we to know, finally, the human species, that what we have been told about long-term radioactive pollution is completely erroneous. That is a deliberate lie, that it is a fraud, and that, in fact, there is nothing to fear from that particular aspect of radiation. Although, I would add, and this is a massive caveat, it's about time to understand what is radioactive contamination on her terms. That's what I would like to know. Wouldn't you like to know that? What is so-called radioactive decay / contamination on her terms? What is it to her? What is it in the process of her dreaming? What is it within the synergy and symbiosis of her own ionic field of life force that fills and pervades the very atmosphere we breathe? Now, I can say that something that struck me as true, coming from Galen Windsor around 1987, was he said that the levels of danger of radioactive contamination due to half-life decay, etc., were completely fictional. That they had been set at a certain limit, and that limit was meaningless, because actually human animals can sustain hundreds or thousands of levels higher exposure to radioactivity without harm. Now, why did that strike me as being true? Well, look at what's happening today since Fukushima, since March of 2011. People are running around screaming their heads off and pointing to the government and saying how dishonest it is and how irresponsible it is that the government of Japan and the United States seemingly in an arbitrary fashion raised the levels of safe exposure to radioactivity. And in some cases they raised them not just 10 times or 50 times, but hundreds of times. Well, how is it conceivable that 50 years ago, when these levels were established, presumably on scientific grounds, on experimental and clinical grounds, how is it possible that those limits could suddenly be raised exponentially? Well, go back to what Galen Windsor said in 1987. They don't mean anything in the first place. Now, another thing that's really shocking to consider is that the entire protocol of safety around nuclear materials and the elaborate and insanely complicated and expensive process of disposing of and burying these materials could be a total charade. It could be like screening for terrorists by the TSA. Just imagine if that were the case. Just imagine. Now, I'm not saying that tanks full of nuclear waste are not pollutants. The problem on this planet is that we pollute the planet, but we pollute it with industrial and chemical substances that are byproducts of the Industrial Revolution. So there's plenty of observable forms of pollution, and it could be that the nuclear waste is just another form of pollution, like from asbestos or any other industrial byproduct. That could be so. Imagine if that were so. Imagine if the entire protocol of hazmat. Isn't that what it's called? Hazardous material? Hazmat suits and masks and washing off and handling these materials. Suppose all of that is a huge charade that was created intentionally to deceive and mislead us, a massive act of duplicity. It's worth considering that this could be the case. Because when you look at Chernobyl and when you look at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I'm sorry. What am I apologizing for? I'm not sorry at all, but you don't find what you would expect to find if lethal contamination by radioactive decay is what they say it is. There's no evidence of that among the populations of Japan, and there's no evidence of that among the populations of Russia around Chernobyl. Do you know today that there are tourist buses that go to Chernobyl? They take hundreds of people there every day and walk around and look at the ruins. There's a lot of wild animals who've moved in because they wouldn't allow the people to move back to the town. A crew member sent me a documentary about some old Russian babushkas, some old grandmothers who refused to leave, and they're still living there. They're in their 80s. They were what, in their 50s when that happened? They're in their 80s and they're perfectly fine. And they're living at Chernobyl. Now, it's true there have been some mutations of plants said to be associated with the problem at Chernobyl. There are mutations in the Pacific Ocean now said to be associated with radioactive leakage from Hiroshima. But is that exactly provable? Nature produces mutations all the time. The Aeon Sophia is herself producing the mutation of Anthropos 10 into Anthropos 11 as I speak. Could it be that the timing of Fukushima with reset, the coincidence of that timing with reset, has something to tell us about her process of transmutation of species? What is radioactive decay on her terms? What is it in terms of her life force? Now, I can't at this moment confirm to you by telestic investigation what I'm going to say next. So you need to take it with a grain of salt, or perhaps with a grain of radium. Speaking of which, do you know how Marie Curie died? Have you heard that she died from poisoning by exposure to radium or other radioactive substances? Yeah, well, I've heard that too. Who hasn't heard that? But is that true? How old was she when she died? And did she in fact die? Is it provable that she in fact died of those causes or not? So, take what I say now with a grain of radium. Everything is material. And the breath of the planetary animal mother is, likewise, material. Her breath is iodine. That is to say, not that she breathes iodine. The planetary animal mother, the living planet, the Gaian superorganism, does not just breathe iodine as if it were a content in her breathing. It is her breath. Iodine is her breathing. Everything is material. Well, if iodine is her breathing, then consider this. Consider what the actual empirical and clinical evidence shows, and set aside inferences and assumptions and extrapolations based on non-falsifiable propositions. So get this.
And by all means, correct me if I'm wrong. But as far as I know, there is no evidence in Russia of physical harm, deformation, a mutation, and death due to the radioactive fallout, except as it goes into milk. And in particular, at Chernobyl, children who drank milk contracted thyroid cancer. Now, the thyroid is particularly sensitive to iodine. And I believe it has been shown that it was radioactive iodine in the milk that caused an extraordinary escalation of cases of thyroid cancer among infants in Chernobyl. Okay, there you have your proof of the danger of radiation, correct? Yes, correct. But what you have is proof of a selective sliver of mutation and harm due to radiation. A very small, minute sliver connected directly to iodine. And if you look at the broader spectrum of health among the people who were exposed to Chernobyl, that is to say, exposed to the long-term radiation, well, there is no evidence that they died excessively of cancers or any other diseases due to those allegedly dangerous emanations, those dangerous emissions, those radiations only detectable by a Geiger counter, by a physical instrument. The levels of radiation from Chernobyl are known to have produced escalations of thyroid cancer in children who drank milk. Now, this is what specifically you need to look at. Because this, as far as I know, is the only specific clinical and verifiable result of exposure at Chernobyl. Why the thyroid? And why iodine? Well, go read about iodine and the thyroid. One of the things you'll find about iodine is that it is a mineral absolutely essential to the maintenance of all physiological and chemical processes in the human body. It's all about iodine. Fukushima and Chernobyl are all about iodine. The Pacific Ocean is full of iodine, as are all the oceans, but particularly the Pacific. Maybe the Japanese, after World War II, were able to enjoy immunity against some possible health risks posed by radioactive decay because they ate so much iodine. Seaweed is one of the staples of the Japanese diet. They live in an atmosphere saturated with iodine. I can remember taking a bus once for a one-day excursion from Tokyo out to the coast, sitting on the ledges there, and just smelling the iodine was so strong, could feel it on your skin. So, what is iodine to her? It is her breath. It is the breath of the planetary animal mother. And what is radioactive decay? What is long-term radiation on her terms? What is it in her physiochemical makeup? Well, we don't know. And again, I have not had the opportunity to verify what I'm going to say to you now by telestic investigation. So I'll just leave it to your
discretion, to consider that what we call long-term radioactive decay resulting from nuclear events, which we don't even understand what they are. What is nuclear fission? We don't understand. It cannot be what it is, because the model of the atom is entirely wrong. But whatever it is, it's possible that this radiation, which the human species has been taught to fear, could be bionic excitation that the Aeons of Fire uses to produce rapid mutations in animal species, including the human animal, and in all other life forms on the planet. It could be bionic excitation, which in her field of symbiosis is safe and natural, but is terrifying to the human animal, because in fact we are terrified by the thought that we could be mutated. Mutation carries a kind of a nightmarish connotation, doesn't it? Mutations, such as you see in Iraq, the birth mutations and birth defects, such as you see in Iraq over the last decade, are terrifying and horrific to behold. Now, wouldn't those birth defects and mutations be evidence that long-term nuclear radiation is dangerous? No, absolutely not. First of all, they're not long-term. They've happened in the last 10 years. Who knows if you would continue to have such mutations or worse over the next 50 or 150 or 1,000 or 150,000 years. It's ridiculous to speculate. Furthermore, I submit to you that those horrific mutations and birth defects in Iraq are due to the particulate matter. They are due to the exposure to the dust of the depleted uranium missiles, and the pollution of particulate matter in the air. Radioactive decay is not particulate matter, is it? But those unfortunate people in Iraq are suffering from a massive pollution of their environment by the detonation of armaments, and some of those armaments do indeed have depleted uranium in them. I think that even Galen Windsor pointed out that the nuclear industry has its dangers like any other industry. Exposure to nuclear materials could be as dangerous as exposure to coal dust or asbestos or byproducts of petroleum distillation, of course. But I submit to you, first of all, that the birth defects in Iraq are not long-term, they're short-term. And secondly, that they could be due to direct environmental pollution. The whole problem on this planet since Silent Spring and Rachel Carson is about environmental pollution of detectable material substances. It's not about some kind of phantom pollution. Radioactive contamination is a phantom pollution that we have been told to fear. Now just imagine if the coincidence of Fukushima with the beginning of reset contains a lesson for the human species, a lesson in duplicity. And just imagine that that lesson comes to light at the end of the 3-year period of reset. And what is that lesson? Well, it could be that we've been conned about nuclear energy for the very reasons that Galen Windsor says, to control the industry and to keep the oil and petroleum business in the dominant position. Now, don't get me wrong, friends and crew. I am not a fan of nuclear-powered energy at all. I think it's not a free energy solution. I think it's incredibly cumbersome and complicated. But nevertheless, I'm willing to allow some latitude in my view of what nuclear energy produces. Nuclear energy, the nuclear energy industry, is one thing. But the claims about billions of years of half-life decay that are going to genetically mutate the human species in some monstrous manner is quite something different. And the one thing that I have now come to realize since discovering Galen Windsor a month or so ago is that I need to distinguish extremely carefully against those two aspects of nuclear energy. I think that it would be astounding and spectacular were it to turn out, were it to be shown openly, that what we have been told about long-term radiation disease is a complete lie. Another pillar of duplicity, another plank of duplicity in the platform of lies that have been deliberately constructed on this planet so that a small number of bankers and industrialists can maintain power over the resources of life. And it's as simple as that. I think it really is. At the end of the day, I think it's as simple as that. The final comment that I would make on Fukushima is that even Busby is confused. You know, there's this British nuclear commentator expert, so-called. He's been debunked by some people. And his name is Busby, B-U-S-B-Y. And I caught him on an interview last month. Now, let's recall, as I'm completing this NAV briefing, which needs to be go into a second segment because there's not enough time to cover everything. But let's recall, as I'm completing part one of this briefing, number 110, that it was predicted that the debris from Hiroshima would reach the coast of California in January of 2014. Okay, well, we all know how January of 2014 kicked off, don't we? The Kali shift began on the 2nd, and January of 2014, I can barely remember getting my sock knocked off like that. Celestics came in on the 6th or 7th of January. The spray breaking over the bow, my mateys. The spray breaking over the bow. Wow. We're in to very high seas here. And interestingly, at the moment that the mothership reaches the high seas of correction, we are told, coincidentally, that there's going to be massive and catastrophic wash-up on the shores of California and Oregon, the west coast of the United States, Baja California, and that there's going to be a massive flux of radioactive contamination. And so what happens? Well, Alex Jones sends his crew out there. Alex Jones, the alarmist, the fear-monger, sends his crew out there to walk around the coast of California with Geiger counters and prove that it's true. Oh, yes, you know. Oh, yeah, the levels of radiation are like off the charts now. And interviewing people who are walking along the beach and just living their lives as if it's not affecting them at all. Well, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's a Mephisto game. Maybe you've been psyoped into thinking that it must be affecting them, that they must be under some kind of phantom radiation danger that's going to mutate them into horrible creatures, and they don't even know it. But what if that's all a fraud? What if that aspect of the narrative around nuclear energy is a fraud? I can barely get my mind around this. What an immense awakening it would be. If that were so, and if it ever came to be widely known to be so. I mean, that is big. That is huge. Now, I could be wrong. I could be wrong. And everything that scientists have told us about long-term radioactive decay, destroying the human species and all life on Earth, could be correct. But I want to see the fracking evidence. As I said, when I was up on Infinity Ridge in May, under the altar of the vultures, show me the fucking evidence. This is how I talk to the Aeon Sophia at moments when I'm a little bit overexcited. You see? Show me the evidence. I want to see the damn evidence. That's one of the great things about human dignity. One of the things that does make our species indeed noble and exceptional is that we know what evidence is. And we demand to see the evidence. And so far, I don't see that evidence regarding the danger of radioactive decay. And on the other hand, to conclude this briefing, let me return to my main point. Busby, the expert, was consulted in January because it was considered to be the moment when the Fukushima debris washes up on the shore, you know, when the shit hits the fan, as it were. And Busby himself, given that this guy is not a fraud, and I don't think he is, openly admitted that he couldn't figure out what was going on. And he claimed that it is impossible for us, to actually tell what the effects are because no one is putting any money on the line to do the proper research. So he sort of weaseled out an explanation saying, well, I can't give you confidently an opinion because no one is paying for the research that would be required scientifically to have a competent opinion. And then he went on to speculate about the breakdown of the food chain in the Atlantic, excuse me, in the Pacific. And he went on to say that he was kind of like hedging his bets. You know, it was a really strange interview because he was saying, well, I wouldn't attribute it to radioactive decay exactly, to the presence of radioactivity in the ocean, because we don't have sufficient evidence of that. But maybe it's due to the particulate matter that carries the radioactive contamination. Now, what the fuck does that mean? You see? Excuse me. What the frack does that mean? So, Busby is confused. We're in the midst of a big Mephisto game of smoke and mirrors when it comes to Fukushima. And it cannot be a coincidence that Fukushima coincides with reset. And so I leave you with this consideration. What we call radioactive contamination is a bionic excitation that facilitates mutations intended by the Aeon Sophia herself. They are effects of her first attention in the depths of material life on this planet, in the depths of matter. Her first attention operates in a way that can be detected by what I am calling bionic excitation. What is bionic excitation? Well, go read Wilhelm Reich on the function of the orgasm, where he describes the discovery of bions, and the cancer biopathy. in which he goes more deeply into what are bions. Now, I believe, I haven't reviewed the material, but I believe that Reich, who lived at the dawn of the era of nuclear energy, who was living in Rangeley, Maine in the 50s, 50 miles from where I lived in Friendship, I believe that Reich considered that nuclear energy and nuclear contamination was DOR, or deadly ozone radiation. So Reich, as far as I can recall, I really need to go back and review the source writings, but Reich posed a sort of Manichaean dichotomy in the life energy on this planet, didn't he? He said that there is the primary life energy which pervades the entire universe, and that is ozone. But he said that there is also a DOR, or deadly ozone radiation, which he equated, I believe, with nuclear radiation. Well, at the time that he did so, in the 50s, it was no more than a decade after the first atomic bomb was exploded, as far as we know, in White Sands, New Mexico. No more than a decade since the end of World War II. And so what did Reich or anybody else know about the long-term effects of nuclear radiation? Absolutely nothing. So I'm beginning to wonder if Reich may not have made an error, which would have been an understandable error in his time and within the limitations of his research at that time, because he was under a lot of stress, and the feds took him down, as you know. So I'm wondering, what is DOR? And is radioactive contamination really deadly or not? Or is it Gaia's way to incite material and alchemical transmutations upon Earth? Is it the alchemy of her first attention at work? I ask you to consider that question, and hang on. I'll close this briefing here and follow up with the second part of NB 110 as soon as I can get around to it.